Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The United States says the situation in Iraq, provincial capital of Ramadi, remains fluid and contested, even as the Islamic State group claims to have captured the city of the country's largest province, Anbar. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
The U.S. Defense Department is challenging the Islamic State group's claim that it has seized Ramadi. A Pentagon spokesman said the situation remains fluid and contested. He said the U.S.-led coalition is supporting the Iraqis with air power. The IS group fought its way to Ramadi's center on Friday. A final push by militants began Sunday with bombings that killed at least 10 Iraqi security force personnel. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi urged Iraqi forces not to abandon their posts and ordered Shia militia to prepare to enter the fight for Anbar province. In Syria, troops have pushed IS fighters back from the ancient city of Palmyra, a UN-designated World Heritage Site, in a battle that reportedly left hundreds dead. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Following episodes of racially charged unrest that brought militarized troops onto the streets of Ferguson, Missouri and Baltimore, Maryland, the U.S. government is imposing new federal restrictions on some military-style equipment for local law enforcement. The federal government is halting funding of gear such as tracked armored vehicles, weaponized aircraft, grenade launchers, and camouflage equipment that an interagency group found eroded public trust in law enforcement. President Barack Obama is expected to discuss the new measures when he travels Monday to Camden, New Jersey, an eastern city that has one of the nation's highest rates of violent crime. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has met with South Korean President Park Geun-hye and Foreign Minister Yoon Byung-se in Seoul to discuss security on the Korean Peninsula and bilateral issues. At a joint news conference after the meetings on Monday, Kerry said North Korea has not even come close to taking the steps needed to rein in its nuclear weapons program for Washington to initiate talks, adding that it was necessary to boost pressure on Pyongyang.
The United States continues to offer Pyongyang an improved bilateral relationship if and only if and when it demonstrates a genuine willingness to fulfill its denuclearization obligations and commitments, and when it shows a willingness to address other important concerns shared by the international community.
North Korea is already under heavy UN sanctions for its missile and nuclear tests. Amtrak trains began rolling early Monday on the busy Northeast Corridor that includes Boston, New York, and Washington. It was the first time in almost a week that service has been fully operational since a deadly crash in Philadelphia. Railroad President Joseph Boardman said Amtrak worked around the clock to restore service following last Tuesday night's deadly derailment that killed 8 people and injured more than 200 others. The UN Security Council has condemned fighting in 2 northern states in South Sudan and the repeated violations of a ceasefire agreement the government and rebels signed early last year. In a statement late Sunday, the council said a government military offensive in Unity State caused large-scale violence that has forced 100,000 people from their homes and halted aid delivery to civilians in the area. The council also blamed the rebels for launching an attack on the town of Malakal in Upper Nile State. Ukraine says 3 of its soldiers were killed, 17 wounded in new fighting with pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Ukrainian military spokesman Andriy Lysenko said 2 of the deaths occurred from a mortar attack near a town northeast of the rebel stronghold of Donetsk. Meanwhile, U.S. Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs Victoria Nuland is in Moscow for meetings with Russian officials in a new bid to try to implement the truce. 11 U.S. Republican presidential contenders gathered in the central state of Iowa Saturday to appeal to party activists on why they should get the party's 2016 presidential nomination. The forum was sponsored by the Iowa Republican Party and was dominated by discussions of Iran, Islam, and the unrest in the Middle East, with several candidates calling for a tougher stance against Tehran, more attacks on Islamic State insurgents. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wahib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
People continue to flee Burundi. We're now talking about a total of 112,000 people who have moved to either Tanzania, Rwanda, or the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
That's UNHCR spokeswoman talking about the flow of refugees from Burundi. Details coming up.
Also, the UN Security Council condemns fighting in two northern states in South Sudan and the repeated violations of a ceasefire agreement between the government and rebels signed early last year.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, protesters took to the streets of the capital of Burundi today for the first time since a failed coup attempt against the president last week. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports from Bujumbura that military forces took a stronger leading role in keeping a damper on demonstrations against the government.
Protesters gathered in the same quarters of the city where they had been demonstrating against President Pierre Nkurunziza for the past 4 weeks, saying his plan to run again violates the law. In past protests, demonstrators have thrown stones at the police from behind makeshift barricades in the streets. Police officers have responded with tear gas and live gunfire. The military has taken a mostly neutral position, standing between protesters and the police to prevent further violence. But on Monday, days after a renegade commander attempted to overthrow the president, the military's role appeared to change. Heavily armed soldiers actively put down the demonstrations, pulling apart roadblocks and dispersing protesters by firing guns into the air. In the Chibitoki neighborhood, resident Blaise Ndesienga told VOA there are divisions among the military here.
We try to analyze the army are divided into groups. The army who are in the other side are against the term of Nkurunziza. But this side they are with Nkurunziza.
In the Musaga neighborhood, the split between military divisions became more apparent when foreign journalists saw two groups of soldiers nearly come to blows in a disagreement about how to treat the protesters. The demonstrations themselves have lost a bit of steam since the coup. Only a few hundred people came out Monday in Musaga, one of the hot spots of the protest movement. Many protesters said they did not want to be associated with those who launched the coup, possibly for fear of reprisal. But the message remains the same, according to Claude Ndazeya, a Bujumbura resident who supports the protests. The president himself says that Burundi is a poor country, he said, and he has governed for 10 years, and now he wants another 5 years, but we are still poor. The ruling party should choose another candidate. In another development Monday, President Nkurunziza announced a cabinet shuffle, replacing his ministers of defense and foreign affairs following the failed coup. The president has pushed on with his plans to run for another term, while regional leaders have urged the country to postpone elections scheduled for the end of June due to the unrest. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Bujumbura.
Burundians continue to flee the political uncertainty and sporadic violence in the country. They're crossing into Tanzania, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Thousands more have done so over the weekend. Karine de Grille is a spokeswoman for the UN Refugee Agency. From Geneva, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa.
People continue to flee Burundi. We're now talking about a total of 112,000 people who have moved to either Tanzania, Rwanda, or the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Any word on their condition?
Yes, we're very concerned, in particularly in the refugees who are currently in Tanzania. There is this small village where people are basically trapped. It's on the Tanzanian side of the border. It's surrounded by a mountain range, and we estimate there's some 50,000 people. And over the weekend, we've had some cases of acute watery diarrhea. So we're very concerned that this could be something very serious and stepping up efforts to prepare for the worst, including with a cholera treatment center.
This is in the village of Kagunga?
Exactly, yes. An estimated 50,000 people, refugees from Burundi, are there. Well, we have been moving them out of Kagunga and into a refugee camp by boat. We've now hired a second boat, and we are also clearing a path so that the younger and fitter refugees can move out on foot over the mountain range.
Now, I remember last week when we spoke to UNHCR, they had the single boat operating, so only a small number of people could be moved at any one time. How many people are able to be moved now with two boats?
With two boats, we're talking about a maximum capacity of 800 people, and we have been fast-tracking pregnant women, sick people, elderly, the most vulnerable people, to get them out first. And once the path is open, and we're talking a matter of days, and the way station is set up so that we can provide water on the way, people will also start moving on foot, so that will speed up the process.
What about food? Are supplies available to them?
They are. We have been giving them some assistance. Food doesn't seem to be the most urgent need, because people brought some food with them, and of course they also have the lake and they are fishermen. So they have been able to fish. Food is not the most urgent need. It's really clean drinking water and shelter, and then of course relocating people to a safer and cleaner place.
So what can be done to improve the drinking water supplies?
We have these water treatment pills that we're moving in, so that people can clean their water with these pills. And there's also a matter of educating them that they need to boil the water for an amount of time before it's safe to drink. And so we've also stepped up these information campaigns so that people can manage a little bit better before they can get on the boat.
So does UNHCR have people stationed at the border with Rwanda, Tanzania, and DRC to greet and register the refugees?
We have two reception centers. If we're talking now about Rwanda, we have two reception centers a little bit away from the border. We ourselves are not at the border, but we have a local partner who is at the border with monitors, and so they help people to come to the reception center where we register them and give them initial assistance before moving them to the camp. We also have teams going to Kagunga. Again, now we're talking about Tanzania, on a regular basis. We don't have a presence there because of the conditions, but we go there obviously every day with the boats. And we also have our teams there who bring in supplies and move people away.
Now, some of the refugees are going to South Kivu province in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And of course, as you know, South Kivu has not been the safest place in recent years due to various militant groups. Is UNHCR at all concerned about their safety?
We are concerned about safety in South Kivu. As you say, it's been an unstable region for many years now. The areas where the refugees are going seem to be rather calm and quiet these days. The refugees are going to villages where there are other Burundian refugees who have been living there for many years now. So that's also where they can find some help. And that's one of the reasons why we're not setting up a refugee camp, although some of the refugees might wish to go to a specially dedicated site, but they will be using services that are already available to the local population, which we will, of course, reinforce.
Karen De Grille is a spokeswoman for the UN Refugee Agency from Geneva. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa.
The Nigerian military says it has destroyed 10 more Boko Haram camps in the nation's vast Sambisa forest. An army spokesman says a combined ground and air campaign continues to overwhelm the militants in their final stronghold in northeastern Nigeria. However, on Saturday, a female suicide bomber killed 7 civilians in Damaturu, the capital of Yobe State, and injured 27 other residents, many of them critically. Such hit-and-run attacks on military and civilian targets lend credibility to claims by outside experts that the military campaign will only force Boko Haram to return to guerrilla tactics of the past. In 6 years, Boko Haram has killed thousands of people and abducted thousands more. At least 1.5 million Nigerians have been displaced.
The UN Security Council has condemned fighting in two northern states in South Sudan and the repeated violations of a ceasefire agreement the government and rebels signed early last year. In a statement late yesterday, The council said a government military offensive in Unity State caused large-scale violence that has forced 100,000 people from their homes and halted aid delivery to civilians in the area. The council also blamed the rebels for launching an attack on the town of Malakal in Upper Nile State. A bloc of East African nations that has been trying to mediate the conflict between President Salva Kiir's government and rebels backing former Vice President Riek Machar said it was deeply frustrated by the rebel violence in Malakal. The Intergovernmental Authority on Development urged both sides to follow through on their agreement and find a peaceful end to the crisis.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel says the World Health Organization was too slow in reacting to the Ebola crisis in West Africa and needs to become a more centralized organization. Ms. Merkel made her remarks at the 68th World Health Assembly in Geneva. She also says the German government is pledging nearly $230 million to strengthen the health services of developing countries. One-third of that amount will target Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, where government health services were devastated by Ebola epidemic that has killed more than 11,000 people. Meanwhile, World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan told the Assembly that the world was ill-prepared to respond to an outbreak that was so widespread, so severe, so sustained, and so complex. She said the WHO was overwhelmed, as were all other responders, She added that the demands on WHO were more than 10 times greater than ever experienced in the almost 70-year history of the organization.
Public policy research organizations, also known as think tanks, have emerged over the past five decades to shape and formulate government policy. The Washington, D.C.-based Results for Development Institute says there are more than 6,000 think tanks in Africa, Asia, the Americas, and the U.K. Raymond Strike is an economist and senior fellow at the Institute and author of Improving Think Tank Management. He said there are many lessons to be learned if think tanks want to maintain their viability in a crowded public policy research industry. He spoke with me about the challenges facing think tanks to ensure their place as a major driver of policy development.
The demand as think tanks grow for competent senior analysts keeps going up, as you would imagine, and supply isn't really keeping up with that, and Africa is a good example of that problem. Over 85% of African think tanks, according to our data, find it just really very difficult to recruit capable young PhDs as analysts, and many of these are people who are coming back from overseas universities to start their professional lives. And think tanks are getting outbid on the money side of it. And I think that what we find is that the incentive package has to be well beyond money to be effective. And if I can just play that out for a minute, many of these young analysts are very interested in their professional development. And we have to remember, these are people who are just largely directly out of graduate school.
What does the future hold for think tanks?
Broadly, I think the future is quite bright. The number of countries that I'm familiar with, I think, have held back building within government agencies strong, what I would call, policy development and research, because think tanks are providing a lot of that information, so that think tanks are becoming a more important and a more permanent part of the policy decision-making process. That's good news for the think tanks, because to the extent that government believes they need more research underpinning their decisions, they're likely to contract with think tanks to do it. And so the think tanks then become less dependent on international assistance. 70% of think tanks get more than two-thirds of their funding from international sources. So they're enormously dependent on outside funding.
Does the funding in any way affect the way they provide their analysis?
International funding, I think, is neutral. But there are some issues with, in some countries, with government agencies. Sometimes the perception that if a think tank is accepting government money, it's probably adjusting their conclusions to be consistent with whoever is buying it wants. I have some information on that for Nigeria. Some quite careful analysis was done on that. The results were really quite interesting. Think tanks that worked on technical issues and those that had a professional track record had very few cases, in fact, none that anybody documented. On the other hand, those that were more likely to have interference were those focusing on questions of, on a political or ideological nature. Let me make one more point here, though. It's really important, and that is that the major gain for working for government agencies is that the think tank is working on issues important enough to the government for it to pay for it. And that means that the think tank really often becomes a close advisor on the issue and thereby has kind of an inside track on affecting policy.
Is there any problem with quality control with these think tanks?
That's a good question, because I think quality control is something of a struggle for many. Let me give you a couple of statistics for the 59 think tanks on which I have data, 20 of which are in Africa. 62% have no written policy on reviews for documents or other products, and 80% assign responsibility to the principal investigator for getting reviews for at least some of the products for which that person's responsible, which sets up something of a conflict of interest. So at a minimum, there are likely to be significant variances within an organization of a standards applied and review rigor and so on. On the other hand, there are always strong performers. Out of this 59, there is a cohort that really does very well. And I know of two African think tanks that have really strong quality control policy statements. And one is the African Institute for Applied Economics in Nigeria. The other is the Economic Policy Research Center in Uganda. And in fact, its policy statement is included in a new book that we have out. All the annexes are online and on the R4D website.
Raymond Strike is an economist and senior fellow at the Results for Development Institute. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
Turkey's president has warned Egypt that a death sentence for former President Mohamed Morsi will throw the Middle East into turmoil. A spokesman for President Tayyip Erdogan says Turkey will take its concerns to the UN Human Rights Commission. Amnesty International has called the court decision a charade based on null and void procedures and demanded Mr. Morsi's release or retrial in a civilian court. An Egyptian court issued the death sentence to Mr. Morsi and 100 members of the Muslim Brotherhood on Saturday for escaping from prison during the 2011 Arab uprising. Death sentences are not final until the Grand Mufti of Egypt, a respected religious scholar, approves them.
Mozambique's foreign minister has expressed surprise that more than 400 Mozambicans have been deported from South Africa for failing to have proper immigration papers. Odemiro Baloyi says his government had expected to negotiate the status of those picked up by South African security. The deportations come weeks after anti-foreigner attacks in Durban that killed seven people. One of the victims was from Mozambique. South Africa denies police targeted foreigners, but it acknowledges that among the nearly 4,000 arrests made, the April clashes, more than 1,600 are illegal immigrants. South African officials officially condemned the violence and sought to address complaints that immigrants living in the country illegally are taking job opportunities from South Africans.
And in news from outside the continent, the United States says the situation in the Iraqi provincial capital of Ramadi remains fluid and contested, even as the Islamic State group claims to have captured the city in the country's largest province, Anbar. VOA's Victor Beatty reports uncertainty over the fate of Ramadi comes as U.S. lawmakers praised U.S. Special Forces for a raid in eastern Syria that killed a senior Islamic State leader.
The U.S. Defense Department is challenging the Islamic State group's claim that it has seized Ramadi. A Pentagon spokesman said the situation remains fluid and contested. He said the U.S.-led coalition is supporting the Iraqis with air power. Sunday, combined Joint Task Force Operation Inherent Resolve conducted 7 airstrikes that targeted several IS tactical units, destroying 4 resupply structures, 3 fighting positions, 2 insurgent-held buildings, 2 heavy machine guns, and 2 vehicles. Airstrikes were also conducted against IS targets near Beji, Fallujah, Mosul, Sinjar, and Tal Afar. The IS group fought its way to Ramadi's center on Friday. A final push by militants began Sunday with bombings that killed at least 10 Iraqi security force personnel. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi urged Iraqi forces not to abandon their posts and ordered Shia militia to prepare to enter the fight for Anbar province. RAND Corporation senior political scientist and career U.S. Army officer Rick Brennan says there are still pockets held by Iraqi security forces within Ramadi.
It's contested. It was significant in the fact that they captured the Anbar Operations Center. They were able to raise the flag, but they no sooner got there than they had to disperse and to go out into other areas out of fear of U.S. airstrikes. So again, it was a tactical victory for ISIS, but the battle's still taking place.
Brennan says despite the retaking of the city of Tikrit by Iraqi-led security forces in early April, IS remains in control of Fallujah and Hit in the west, as well as part of the oil refinery near Beji and Mosul to the north. In April, the Pentagon said since the U.S.-led air campaign began in August, the IS group had lost between 25% and 30% of the territory it controlled in Iraq. In Syria, troops have pushed IS fighters back from the ancient city of Palmyra, a UN-designated World Heritage Site, in a battle that reportedly left hundreds dead. U.S. lawmakers have praised U.S. Special Forces for a raid in eastern Syria late Friday into Saturday that killed senior IS leader Abu Sayyaf and resulted in the capture of his wife Sayyaf, a suspected IS member who likely played a role in the group's terrorist activities. House Intelligence Chairman Congressman Devin Nunes says it is a tactic that he and others had long advocated as a way to gather intelligence.
It takes guts for the administration and our military to put an action like this together. It was successful. We're happy that they got back and got back safely. Now, over the coming weeks, we'll know what they were actually able to gather there.
Nunez describes the U.S. strategy against the IS group as one of containment that will not degrade or destroy it because the militant group extends beyond Iraq and Syria into North Africa.
And I say that because many of the fighters we know are coming from North Africa. And if you don't stop that flow of fighters, plus the flow of fighters from the West that are coming down in through Turkey, getting trained and then coming out to the West, you're going to have an ever-increasing terrorist threat for the United States and our allies.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says the Obama administration did the right thing in conducting the operation and called for more such capture and interrogate actions. The former director of Central Intelligence, Michael Morell, described Abu Sayyaf as incredibly important to the IS group and says his wife should be able to reveal a lot. As for the documents that may have been captured,
one is a document about how effective weapons of mass destruction can be against the enemy. That's us. One of those documents talks about how you actually make bubonic plague and how you use that against the enemy. That's us. And the other document in there is a document that talks about the religious justification for using weapons of mass destruction.
Senator Dianne Feinstein, ranking member on the Senate's Intelligence Committee, says the IS group remains active in at least 12 countries, describing it as organized and impressive fighting force, one that occupies territory, runs a government, and is evil. She says the West must get serious about more than just containing the Islamic State group. It must find a way, she says, to eradicate it. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Burundians continue to flee the political uncertainty and sporadic violence in their country. The Nigerian military says it has destroyed 10 more Boko Haram camps in the nation's vast Sambisa forest. And the UN Security Council condemns fighting in two northern states in South Sudan and the repeated violations of a ceasefire agreement that the government and rebels signed early last year. Coming up, we'll have music from Cameroon, and in our feature segment, climate change is transforming the planet. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Kim.
And Sunny, I understand you are starting today with basketball.
Kim, let's tip off with the National Basketball Association playoffs.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
Four clubs remain in contention for the NBA title after weekend action. In the Eastern Conference Finals, the Cleveland Cavaliers will play the Atlanta Hawks. That best-of-seven-game series begins Wednesday night in Atlanta, Georgia. And in the Western Conference Finals, the Houston Rockets will take on the Golden State Warriors. That best-of-seven-game series begins Tuesday night in Oakland, California. The Rockets advance Sunday with a 113-100 victory over the visiting Los Angeles Clippers. Houston rallied from a 3-1 deficit and won the series 4-3. In the decisive Game 7, the Rockets were led by star guard James Harden, who scored a game-high 31 points, grabbed 7 rebounds, and passed for 7 assists. Harden talks about the Rockets coming back to win the series.
It's only a handful of teams that's done that, and so gave us confidence. You know, I think that finishing that first series, we kind of, you know, took the series kind of slow in the beginning. You know, it kind of, you know, bit us on the butt, but we fought back. I'm really proud of the guys, man. How they fought all year. You know, and so I'm really tremendously proud of those guys for the way they fight and the way they help me and Dwight. Bring it every single night.
James Harden and the Rockets are heading to the Western Conference Finals for the first time in 18 years. The head coach of Houston is Kevin McHale, who had a Hall of Fame career as a player with the Boston Celtics. McHale gives credit to James Harden and the other Rockets for their fighting spirit.
For the most part, we stayed in attack mode. I thought James was fantastic. You know, 31 points, big free throws down the stretch. He got us going with some passes early. Trevor's shots were so timely and so huge, just big. And again, you know, Dwight, 16 and 15, just, you know, so many people played well. Brew went out there. I mean, Pablo had a hell of a game. And we just had a lot of guys play well. And that's what it takes. It takes a lot of guys playing well to beat a team. And I told our guys, you know, 3-1, it feels really, really, really bad, especially when they stomp on you in games 3 and 4. You know, our guys just kind of grounded out, and it was just a one game at a time. And we, you know, we've had many 3-game winning streaks throughout the year, and our guys just rallied together, and they just did a hell of a job. So that was a really good game for us on both sides of the ball.
That's Kevin McHale, the head coach of the Houston Rockets basketball club, and he was speaking in Houston, Texas. Once again, the matchups for the conference finals in the NBA playoffs. The Rockets will play the Golden State Warriors in the Western Conference Finals, and the Cleveland Cavaliers will go against the Atlanta Hawks in the Eastern Conference Finals. The winners of the two series will advance to the NBA Finals, which tip off June 4th.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled Atukwefio Praised as Pillar of Ghana Football, and I write about Cecil Jones Atukwefio, who died May 12th of throat cancer at age 70. The Ghana Football Association says Atukwefio is remembered as a talented footballer, coach, and administrator who shaped the lives and careers of many Ghanaian football players. Joining us now with a package of football news is the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot, on the spot at Adeyemi.
Good evening, Africa. Nigeria has named its final team for this year's FIFA Under 20 World Cup due to kick off in New Zealand at the end of the month. According to the team list released by Manu Garba, head coach of Nigeria's Flying Eagles, as the country's national Under 20 team is known, skipper Musa Mohamed will lead the team. Others include Taiwo Awoniyi, Kelechi Iheanacho, and Success Isaac, all members of the Nigerian team that won the FIFA Under 17 World Cup in the United Arab Emirates in 2013. At the Under 20 tournament, African champion Nigeria will play its first match against Brazil on June 1st, before taking on North Korea and Hungary in Group E. Nigeria has never won the FIFA Under 20 World Cup since the competition started in 1977, but the country has twice clinched the silver medal at the two yearly tournaments. Apart from Nigeria, other teams that will fly the African flag in New Zealand are Ghana, the only African team to have won the FIFA Under 20 tournament, Mali, and Senegal. Away from Nigeria, an Egyptian court on Saturday banned the country's hardcore soccer fan clubs, known as the Ultras, over terrorism accusations. The Ultras took part in protests during and after the 2011 uprising and frequently clashed with police in and around stadiums. The ruling by the Court of Urgent Matters in Cairo, the Egyptian capital, appeared to be the latest effort by the judiciary to prevent demonstrations. During the 2011 uprising that forced out President Hosni Mubarak, the Ultras played a major role. The court's ruling followed a case filed by Murtada Mansour, the head of the Zamalek Football Club, one of Egypt's most popular teams. Mansour has long been at odds with his team's Ultras organization, known as the White Knights. Last month, 11 fans were sentenced to death in a retrial of over 70 defendants accused in the 2012 soccer riots that left 74 people dead. Since the 2012 stadium violence, authorities have sharply limited attendance at matches. At least 19 people were killed in February when police fired tear gas into a crowd of fans trying to attend the match. Many of the dead suffocated or were crushed. And from Rwanda comes the report that military team APR has won the 2014-2015 Rwanda Football Premier League with one match to spare. On Friday evening, APR played 2-2 with Isonga in the penultimate match. APR's 52 points from 25 matches have guaranteed the title, as there are 6 points between the top team and the second-placed AS Kigali. The latest victory brings to a record 15 the number of league titles that APR has won. The club will represent Rwanda in next year's CAF Champions League. Finally, President Sepp Blatter of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has opposed plans to expand the number of teams at the World Cup. He says he would like to keep the number of participants at the four-yearly soccer extravaganza to 32 if he is re-elected. Blatter is standing for a fifth mandate as FIFA president on May 29th. Two of his three challengers have said he will expand the World Cup to at least 40 teams. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
In African athletics, Blessing Okagbare of Nigeria and Almaz Ayana of Ethiopia were two of the big winners at Sunday's IAAF Diamond League meet in Shanghai, China. In the women's 100 meters race, Blessing beat a strong field that included two-time Olympic champion Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce of Jamaica. Blessing's winning time, 10.98 seconds. The performance signaled that Blessing looks like a top contender for a gold medal at this year's World Championships, which will be held in Beijing, China, at the end of August. Meanwhile, in the women's 5,000 meters race in Shanghai, Almaz Ayana clocked the third fastest time ever, 14 minutes and 14.32 seconds. The 23-year-old Ethiopian was only 3 seconds shy of breaking countrywoman Tirunesh Dibaba's world record. In the women's 800 meters race, Kenya's Eunice Jepkoech Sum took top honors with a time just over 2 minutes even. In the men's 1500 meters race in Shanghai, Silas Kiplagat led a Kenyan sweep of the top three places with a winning time of 3 minutes and 35.29 seconds. In the men's 3,000-meter steeplechase, Kenya again dominated. Kenyan athletes took the top eight places with Jairus Kipchoge Birich, the overall winner in Shanghai, in 8 minutes, 5.36 seconds. Here's a sunny side of sports salute to Southampton Senegalese striker Sadio Mane, who put his name in the English Premier League football record books over the weekend. The 23-year-old Mane recorded the fastest hat trick in EPL history, notching three first-half goals in a span of 176 seconds in Southampton's 6-1 trouncing of visiting Aston Villa. The previous EPL record for speediest hat trick was 4 minutes and 33 seconds by Liverpool's Robbie Fowler against Arsenal in 1994. Sadio Mane blessing the Saints of Southampton with a record performance. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And if you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a photo of Nigerian sprinter Blessing Okagbare running to victory in Shanghai. And my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the United Nations Children's Fund says at least 800,000 children in South Sudan have been separated from at least one parent during 17 months of conflict. And next, climate change could transform our planet unless steps are taken. But first, some music. Here is Julius Esoko of Cameroon with Foolish Men.
We are starving in broad daylight. Poverty, crime, for sure, no right. We are dying while we build in their fortune. Our share is misfortune. What a load that might be. There is time to fight for freedom. Over my dead body, no, never. Say we won't die, build here to con your allies. But we know they are foolish leaders. Crowd.
now. That's the call now. Burning now, burning now. Yeah, 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 yeah. It goes far now. Come on, call now. Like this now. We want more, we want more. Burn the chorus now. Push them now. Get rid of them. Get rid of them. Yep, do, no, 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 no,
Cameroon's Julius Isoka with Foolish Men.
The United Nations Children's Fund says at least 800,000 children in South Sudan have been separated from at least one parent during the fighting between armed supporters of President Salva Kiir and his political rival, former President Riek Machar. More than 2 million people have been displaced from their homes, and humanitarian officials say many families have experienced only pain, anxiety, and struggle. But amid the suffering, there have been some joyful reunions. Mugumbi Davis Wakaringi has more from Juba.
56-year-old Peter Chol was going about his work as a Presbyterian pastor in New Site Village near Bilfam Barracks when South Sudan's conflict first erupted on December 15, 2013. After the fighting broke out, three of his five children fled the family home in Juba.
So I had a man here in Juba. Running for my dear life in the UNMISS camp in Tongpei here. So when the children ran away from me, they found one of the good person taking them to East Africa. They were there for some months. After that, I started to cry for my children. I thought that they are dead because they were in a place called Cor William, where the very dangerous war broke out in.
Chol's two older sons, aged 24 and 20, accompanied him to Tongping. But the three younger children, aged 15, 13 and 6, were taken by a neighbor to Kakuma camp in Kenya, where they were provided with food, health services and education by humanitarian agencies. The youngest of Chol's children, 6-year-old Dwyer Peter, vividly recalls the anguish he experienced while living as a young refugee without his parents. Speaking in Nuer, Dwyer says the woman who was taking care of them would always excuse herself to fetch water and go to the market. He says she would leave the children alone without food or water. So then the children would go from house to house asking for something to eat and drink. He says the locals would call them beggars. UNICEF says at least 600 children are believed to be psychologically distressed due to the violence and displacement. The Child Charity says that along with the more than 800 displaced children in the country, an additional 8,000 have been identified and registered as unaccompanied or separated. UNICEF says such children are vulnerable to even further abuse. Paul Odent, ICRC Coordinator for Restoring Family Links Program, helps connect families in places like South Sudan.
Well, I think it's very traumatizing, and it has a big effect to them. It's a big effect on their education as well, on their physical development, with having limited access to good food and to good nutrition.
Chol still has no information on the whereabouts of his wife or even if she is still alive. She was in Unity State when the conflict began. Despite his anxiety over his wife, Chol is grateful that the ICRC arranged for the reunion with his young children.
So I felt very happy, and I took them to the church for prayer. So we prayed for more than 3 days, and I took more than 5 days in fasting to give thanks to my Lord who rescued my kids.
ICRC has undertaken several initiatives to help people trace missing family members, including a web page that enables visitors to view photos of their loved ones. ICRC's Odent says he was happy to witness Cho's family reunion at the POC.
It was very, very touching and very moving because he was really waiting there with a couple of relatives, and they were crying, and the children hugged him when they stay, and they stay hugging for several minutes. It was very nice.
UNICEF says South Sudan has endured a dramatic degradation in human security, a breakdown of the social fabric and family structures, and a lack of access to basic social services, primarily in Upper Nile, Unity, and Jonglei, the three states directly affected by armed conflict. For now, Chol hopes the conflict will end soon, that his children will be able to resume their education, and that will one day be reunited with his wife. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Climate change is transforming the planet unless steps are taken to reduce global warming. Scientists predict rising seas, stronger and more frequent storms, drought, fire and floods. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports on a new species extinction study, underscoring the need to take action to avoid the most catastrophic effects of rising temperatures.
Mark Urban reviewed 131 articles on species extinction to come up with a global analysis of the issue.
It'd be very easy to take a single study and have an overly optimistic picture of extinction risk or an overly pessimistic. So when we accumulate all those studies to understand the overall picture, we can get a better understanding across all of these studies.
Urban, a professor of ecology and biology at the University of Connecticut, says a common thread runs through all the studies.
The most important one being that as the Earth warms, the extinction risk will increase. And what was most surprising to me is that it's not just a linear increase, but it actually curves upward. So there's an acceleration of those extinction risks as we get into warmer and warmer climates.
Today, 3% of species are at risk of disappearing, but the extinction rate climbs as the planet approaches 4.3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times. Experts say that's a tipping point, which will lead to the worst impacts of climate change.
We reached the point where we're at 16% extinction risk for species, so one in six species could be endangered if we don't do anything about controlling greenhouse gases.
Urban says some regions of the world would be harder hit than others.
The small land masses play a role. Places with lots of endemic species, like Australia and South America, these are species that are already constrained to small ranges, and so even a small shift in those ranges could endanger them.
Climate change will alter species and the habitats in which they live, Urban warns. He says his study gives policymakers and the public added incentive to adopt new strategies to conserve and protect the most threatened species.
We don't need to see these extinctions occur. We can do something right now. And my hope is in 20 years, you know, we can look back and say, well, we averted this disaster.
The study appears in the journal Science. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The government and opposition in South Sudan continue to engage in armed conflict, despite an agreement to end hostilities that have resulted in the death of thousands of innocent South Sudanese citizens and the displacement of over 2 million more. With both sides dug in, the compromises needed to achieve a viable peace agreement remain elusive, putting the future of the world's youngest nation at grave risk. Many South Sudanese have long urged that those responsible for these crimes be held accountable, to break the cycle of violence and revenge, and seek to build a stable, lasting peace. Early this month, the United States announced plans to provide $5 million to promote justice and accountability in South Sudan, pending congressional approval. These funds will support a credible, impartial, and effective justice mechanism, such as a hybrid court, to hold perpetrators of violence in South Sudan to account. Furthermore, the funding will build the capacity of South Sudanese civil society to document human rights violations, work that is critical to understanding events on the ground and that can serve as a starting point for justice and reconciliation efforts. The funds are in addition to ongoing U.S. support for local reconciliation efforts and the more than $1 billion that the United States has contributed to assist humanitarian relief since the start of the crisis in December 2013. The United States continues to stand with the people of South Sudan and will not tolerate impunity for human rights abuses, but will continue to push for peace. We urge others to join us in committing funds to support justice, reconciliation, and healing in South Sudan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Next on Let's Talk. Join host Sandy Shumari and his guests discussing health clubs and fitness. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Her lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.